"'Likely to hire you if they knew your infirmity?' he asked. "'We never agreed,' Roger said. "'You just told me to start wearing the gloves one day.' Eric chuckled. "'Hate to disillusion you, boy, but that's how it is between masters and apprentices. "'No one wants a crippled jongleur.'
"'So that's all I am?' Roger asked. "'A cripple?'
"'Of course not,' Eric said. I wouldn't trade you for any apprentice in Angiers. But not everyone will look past your demon scars to see the man within. They will label you with some mocking name, and you'll find them laughing at you and not with.
I don't care, Roger said. The gloves make me feel like a fraud, and my hand is bad enough without the fake fingers making it clumsier. What does it matter why they laugh if they come and pay clats to do it?
Eric looked at him a long time, tapping his cup. "'Let me see the gloves,' he said at last. They were black and reached halfway up his forearm. Bright-colored triangles of cloth were sewn to the ends, with bells attached. Roger tossed them to his master with a frown. Eric caught the gloves, looked at them for half a moment, and then tossed them out the window, brushing his hands together as if touching the gloves had left them unclean. "'Grab your boots and let's go,' he said, tossing back the remains of his cup. "'I don't really like the boots either,' Roger dared. Eric smiled at the boy. "'Don't push your luck,' he warned with a wink. Guild law allowed licensed jongleurs to perform on any street corner so long as they didn't block traffic or hinder commerce. Some vendors even hired them to attract attention to their booths, or the common rooms of taverns. Eric's drinking had alienated most of the latter, so they performed in the street. Eric was a late sleeper, and the best spots had long since been staked out by other jongleurs. The space they found wasn't ideal. A corner on a side street, far from the main lanes of traffic. "'It'll do,' Eric grunted. "'Drum up some business, boy, while I set up.' Roger nodded and ran off. Whenever he found a likely cluster of people, he cartwheeled by them or walked by on his hands, the bells sewn into his motley ringing an invitation. "'Jongleur show!' he cried. "'Come see Eric Sweetsong perform!' Between his acrobatics and the weight still carried by his master's name, he drew a fair bit of attention. Tom even followed him on his rounds, clapping and laughing at his antics. One man elbowed his wife. "'Look, it's the crippled boy from Small Square!'
"'Are you sure?' she asked.
"'Just look at his hand,' the man said. Roger pretended not to hear, moving on in search of more customers. He soon brought his small following to his master, finding Eric juggling a butcher knife, a meat cleaver, a hand axe, a small stool, and an arrow in easy rhythm, joking with a growing crowd of his own. "'And here comes my assistant,' Eric called to the crowd. "'Roger Halfgrip!' Roger was already running forward when the name registered. What was Eric doing? It was too late to slow, though, so he put his arms out and flung himself forward, cartwheeling into a triple backflip to stand a few yards from his master. Eric snatched the butcher knife from the deadly array in the air before him and flicked it Roger's way. Fully expecting the move, Roger went into a spin, catching the blunt and specially weighted knife easily in his good left hand. As he completed the circuit, he uncoiled and threw, sending the blade spinning right at Eric's head. Eric, too, went into a spin, and came out of the circuit with the blade held tightly in his teeth. The crowd cheered, and as the blade went back up into the rhythm with the other implements, a wave of clats clicked into the hat. "'Roger Halfgrip!' Eric called. "'With only 10 years and 8 fingers, he's still deadlier with a knife than any grown man!' The crowd applauded. Roger held his crippled hand up for all to see, and the crowd oohed and aahed over it. Already, Eric's suggestion had most of them believing he made that catch and throw with his crippled hand. They would tell others, and exaggerate in the telling. Rather than risk Roger being labeled by the crowd, Eric had labeled him first. "'Roger Halfgrip,' he murmured. tasting the name on his tongue. "Hup!" Arik called, and Roger turned as his master flung the arrow at him. He slapped his hands together, catching the missile just before it struck his face. He spun again, putting his back to the crowd. With his good hand, he threw the arrow between his legs back toward his master. But when he finished the move and faced the crowd, his crippled right hand was extended. "Hup!" he called back. Arik feigned fear, dropping the blades he was juggling, but the stool fell into his hands just in time for the arrow to stick in its center. Arik studied it, as if amazed at his own good fortune. He flicked his wrist as he pulled the arrow free, and it became a bouquet of flowers, which he bestowed on the prettiest woman in the crowd. More coins clattered into the hat. Seeing his master moving on to magic, Roger ran to the bag of marvels for the implements Arik would need for his tricks. As he did, there came a cry from the crowd. "Play your fiddle!" a man called. As he did, there was a general buzz of agreement. Roger looked up to see the same man who had called so loudly for Sweet Song the day before. "In the mood for music, are we?" Arik asked the crowd, not missing a beat. He was answered with a cheer, so Arik went to the bag and took the fiddle, tucking it under his chin and turning back to the audience. But before he could put bow to string, the man cried out. "Not you, the boy!" he bellowed. "Let Half Grip play!" Arik looked to Roger, his face a mask of irritation as the crowd began chanting, "Half Grip! Half Grip!" Finally, he shrugged, handing his apprentice the instrument. Roger took the fiddle with shaking hands. Never upstage your master was a rule apprentices learned early. But the crowd was calling for him to play, and again the bow felt so right in his crippled hand, free of the cursed glove. He closed his eyes, feeling the stillness of the strings under his fingertips, and then brought them to a low hum. The crowd quieted as he played softly for a few moments, stroking the strings like the back of a cat, making it purr. The fiddle came alive in his hands then, and he let it out like a partner in a reel, sweeping it into a whirlwind of music. He forgot the crowd. He forgot Arik. Alone with his music, he explored new harmonies even as he maintained a constant melody, improvising in time to the tempo of clapping that seemed a world removed. He had no idea how long it went on. He could have stayed in that world forever. But there was a sharp twang, and something stung his hand. He shook his head to clear it, and looked up at the wide-eyed and silent crowd. "String broke," he said sheepishly. He glanced at his master, who stood in the same shock as the other onlookers. Arik raised his hand slowly and began to clap. The crowd followed soon after, and it was thunderous. "You're going to make us rich with that fiddling, boy," Arik said, counting their take. "Rich!"
"Rich enough to pay the back dues you owe the guild?" a voice asked.
They turned to see Master Jason leaning against the wall. His two apprentices, Sally and Abram, stood close by. Sally sang soprano with a clear voice as beautiful as she was ugly. Arik sometimes joked that if she wore a horned helmet, audiences would mistake her for a rock demon. Abram sang bass, his voice a deep thrum that made the planked streets vibrate. He was tall and lean, with gigantic hands and feet. If Sally was a rock demon, he was surely a wood. Like Arik, Master Jason was an alto, his voice rich and pure. He wore expensive clothes of fine blue wool and gold thread, spurning the motley that most of his profession wore. His long black hair and mustache were oiled and meticulously groomed. Jason was a man of average size, but that made him no less dangerous. He had once stabbed a jongleur in the eye during an argument over a particular corner. The magistrate ruled it self-defense, but that wasn't how the talk in the apprentice room of the guild house told it. "The payment of my guild dues is no concern of yours, Jason," Arik said, quickly dumping the coins in the bag of marvels.
Your apprentice may have talked your way out of missing that performance yesterday, Sour Song, but his fiddle can't sucker you forever.
As he spoke, Abram snatched Roger's fiddle from his hands and broke it over his knee.
Sooner or later the Guild will have your license.
The Guild would never give up Eric's sweet song, Eric said. But even if they did, Jason would still be known as Second Song.
Jason scowled, for many in the Guild already used that name, and the Master was known to fly into rages at its utterance.
He and Sally advanced on Eric, who held the bag protectively. Abram backed Roger against a wall, keeping him from going to his master's aid. But this wasn't the first time they had needed to fight to defend their take. Roger dropped straight down on his back, coiling like a spring and kicking straight up. Abram screamed, his normally deep voice taking on a different pitch.
"I thought your apprentice was a bass, not a soprano," Eric said.
When Jason and Sally spared a glance to their companion, his quick hands darted into the bag of marvels, sending a fistful of wing seeds spinning in the air before them. Jason lunged through the cloud, but Eric sidestepped and tripped him easily, bringing the bag around in a hard swing at Sally, hitting the bulky woman full in the chest. She might have kept her feet, but Roger was in position, kneeling behind her. She fell hard, and before the three could recover, Eric and Roger ran off down the boardwalk. Chapter 16. Attachments. 323 to 325 AR. The roof of the Duke's library in Milne was a magical place for Arlen. On a clear day, the world spread out below him, a world unrestrained by walls and wards, stretching on into infinity. It was also the place where Arlen first looked at Mary, and truly saw her. His work in the library was nearly complete, and he would soon be returning to Cobb's shop. He watched the sun play over the snow-capped mountains and fall on the valley below, trying to memorize the sight forever. And when he turned to Mary, he wanted to do the same for her. She was 15, and more beautiful by far than mountains and snow. Mary had been his closest friend for over a year, but Arlen had never thought more of her than that. Now, seeing her limbed in sunlight, cold mountain wind blowing the long brown hair from her face as she hugged her arms against the swell of her bosom to ward off the chill, she was suddenly a young woman, and he a young man. His pulse quickened at the way her skirts flared in the breeze, edges of lace hinting of petticoats beneath. He said nothing as he stepped forward, but she caught the look in his eyes and smiled. "It's about time," she said. He reached out tentatively and traced the back of his hand down her cheek. She leaned into the touch, and he tasted her sweet breath, kissing her. It was soft at first, hesitant, but it deepened as she responded. Becoming something with a life of its own, something hungry and passionate, something that had been building inside him for over a year without his knowing. Sometime later, their lips parted with a soft pop, and they smiled nervously. Arms around one another, they looked out over Milne, sharing in the glow of young love. "You're always staring out into the valley," Mary said. She ran her fingers through his hair and kissed his temple. "Tell me what you dream about when your eyes have that faraway look." Arlen was quiet for some time. "I dream of freeing the world from the Corlings," he said. Her thoughts having gone another way, Mary laughed at the unexpected response. She didn't mean to be cruel, but the sound cut at him like a lash. "You think yourself the deliverer, then?" she asked. "How will you do this?" Arlen drew away from her a little, feeling suddenly vulnerable. "I don't know," he admitted. "I'll start by messaging. I've already saved enough money for armor and a horse." Mary shook her head. That will never do if we're to marry, she said.
We're to marry? Arlen asked in surprise, amazed at the tightness in his throat.
Well, am I not good enough?
Mary asked, pulling away and looking indignant.
No, I never said...
Arlen stuttered.
Well then, she said, messaging may bring money and honor, but it's too dangerous, especially once we have children.
We're having children now?
Arlen squeaked. Mary looked at him as if he were an idiot.
No, it will never do, she went on, ignoring him as she thought things through. You'll need to be a warder, like Cobb. You'll still get to fight demons, but you'll be safe with me instead of riding down some corling-infested road.
I don't want to be a warder, Arlen said. It was never more than a means to an end.
What end? Mary asked. Lying dead on the road?
No, Arlen said. That won't happen to me.
What will you gain as a messenger that you can as a warder?
Escape, Arlen said, without thinking. Mary fell silent. She turned her head to avoid his eyes, and after a few moments slipped her arm from his. She sat quietly, and Arlen found sadness only made her more beautiful still.
Escape from what? She asked at last. From me?
Arlen looked at her, drawn in ways he was only just beginning to understand, and his throat caught. Would it be so bad to stay? What were the chances of finding another like Mary? But was that enough? He never wanted family. They were attachments he didn't need. If he'd wanted marriage and children, he might as well have stayed in Tibbetts Brook with Renna.
He thought Mary was different.
Arlen called to mind the image that had sustained him for the last 3 years, seeing himself riding down the road, free to roam. As always, the thought swelled him until he turned to look again at Mary. The fantasy fled, and all he could think about was kissing her again.
Not you, he said, taking her hands. Never you.
Their lips met again, and for a time his thoughts touched on nothing else.
I have an assignment to Harden's Grove, Reagan said, referring to a small farming hamlet a full day's ride from Fort Milne. Would you care to join me, Arlen?
Reagan, no! Alyssa cried.
Arlen glared, but Reagan grabbed his arm before he could speak. Arlen, may I have a moment alone with my wife? He asked gently. Arlen wiped his mouth and excused himself. Reagan closed the door after him, but Arlen refused to let his fate be decided out of his hands, and circled around through the kitchen, listening at the servants' entrance. The cook looked at him, but Arlen looked right back, and the man kept to his own business.
He's too young, Alyssa was saying.
Alyssa, he'll always be too young for you, Reagan said. Arlen is 16, and he's old enough to make a simple day trip.
You're encouraging him!
You know full well Arlen needs no encouragement from me, Reagan said.
Enabling him, then, Alyssa snapped. He's safer here.
He'll be safe enough with me, Reagan said. Isn't it better that he makes his first few trips with someone to supervise him?
I'd rather he not make his first few trips at all, Alyssa said acidly. If you cared about him, you'd feel the same.
Night, Alyssa, it's not like we'll even see a demon. We'll reach the grove before sunset and leave after sunrise. Regular folk make the trip all the time.
I don't care, Alyssa said. I don't want him going.
It's not your choice, Reagan reminded.
I forbid it, Alyssa shouted.
You can't, Reagan shouted back. Arlen had never heard him raise his voice to her.
Just you watch me, Alyssa snarled. I'll drug your horses. I'll chop every spear in two. I'll throw your armor in the well to rust.
Take away every tool you want, Reagan said through gritted teeth, and Arlen and I will still leave for Harden's Grove tomorrow on foot if need be.
I'll leave you, Alyssa said quietly.
What?
You heard me, she said. Take Arlen out of here, and I'll be gone before you get back.
You can't be serious, Reagan said.
I've never been more serious in my life, Alyssa said. Take him, and I go.
Regan was quiet a long time. Look, Alyssa, he said finally. I know how upset you've been that you haven't gotten pregnant.
Don't you dare bring that into this, Alyssa growled. Arlen is not your son, Regan shouted. No amount of smothering will ever make it so. He is our guest, not our child. Of course he's not our child, Alyssa shouted. How could he be when you're out delivering ripping letters whenever I cycle?
You knew what I was when you married me, Regan reminded her.
I know, Alyssa replied. And I'm realizing that I should have listened to my mother.
What's that supposed to mean? Regan demanded.
It means I can't do this anymore, Alyssa said, starting to cry. The constant waiting, wondering if you'll ever come home, the scars you claim are nothing, the praying that the scant few times we make love will conceive before I'm too old. And now this!
I knew what you were when we married, she sobbed. And I thought I had learned to handle it, but this...
Regan, I just can't bear the thought of losing you both. I can't...
A hand rested on Arlen's shoulder, giving him a start. Margaret stood there, a stern look on her face.
You shouldn't be listening to this, she said,
and Arlen felt ashamed for his spying. He was about to leave when he caught the messenger's words. All right, Regan said. I'll tell Arlen he can't come and stop encouraging him.
Really? Alyssa sniffed.
I promise, Regan said. And when I get back from Harden's Grove, he added, I'll take a few months off and keep you so fertilized that something can't help but grow.
Oh, Regan,
Alyssa laughed, and Arlen heard her fall into his arms. You're right, Arlen told Margaret. I had no right to listen to that. He swallowed the angry lump in his throat. But they had no right to discuss it in the first place. He went up to his room and began packing his things. Better to sleep on a hard pallet in Cobb's shop than in a soft bed that came at the cost of his right to make his own decisions. For months, Arlen avoided Regan and Alyssa. They stopped by Cobb's shop often to see him, but he wasn't to be found. They sent servants to make overtures, but the results were the same. Without use of Regan's stable, Arlen bought his own horse and practiced riding in the fields outside the city. Mary and Jake often accompanied him, the three of them growing closer. Mary frowned upon the practice, but they were all still young, and the simple joy of galloping a horse about the fields drove other feelings away. Arlen worked with increasing autonomy in Cobb's shop, taking calls and new customers unsupervised. His name became known in warding circles, and Cobb's profits grew. He hired servants and took on more apprentices, leaving the bulk of their training to Arlen. Most evenings, Arlen and Mary walked together, taking in the colors of the sky. Their kisses grew hungrier, both wanting more, but Mary always pulled away before it went too far.
You'll be done with your apprenticeship in another year, she kept saying. We can marry the next day if you wish, and you can ravish me every night from then on.
One morning, when Cobb was away from the shop, Alyssa paid a visit. Arlen, busy talking to a customer, didn't notice her until it was too late.
Hello, Arlen, she said when the customer left.
Hello, Lady Alyssa, he replied.
There's no need to be so formal, Alyssa said.
I think informality confused the nature of our relationship, Arlen replied. I don't want to repeat the error.
I've apologized again and again, Arlen, Alyssa said. What will it take for you to forgive me?
Mean it, Arlen answered.
The two apprentices at the workbench looked at one another, then got up in unison and left the room.
Alyssa took no notice of them. I do, she said.
You don't, Arlen replied,
gathering some books from the counter and moving to put them away. "You're sorry that I overheard and took offense. You're sorry that I left. The only thing you're not sorry about is what you did, making Reagan refuse to take me." "It's a dangerous trip," Alyssa said carefully. Arlen slammed down the books and met Alyssa's eyes for the first time. "I've made the trip a dozen times in the last 6 months," he said.
"Arlen!"
Alyssa gasped. "I've been to the Duke's mines as well," Arlen went on, "and the South Quarries, everywhere within a day of the city. I've made my circles, and the Messengers Guild's been courting me ever since I gave them my application, taking me wherever I want to go. You've accomplished nothing. I won't be caged, Alyssa. Not by you, not by anyone."
"I never wanted to cage you, Arlen, only to protect you," Alyssa said softly.
"That was never your place," Arlen said, turning back to his work.
"Perhaps not," Alyssa sighed. "But I only did it because I care. Because I love you."
Arlen paused, refusing to look at her.
"Would it be so bad, Arlen?" Alyssa asked. "Cobb isn't young, and he loves you like a son. Would it be such a curse to take over his shop and marry that pretty girl I've seen you with?"
Arlen shook his head. "I'm not going to be a warder, not ever."
"What about when you retire, like Cobb?"
"I'll be dead before then," Arlen said.
"Arlen, what a terrible thing to say." "Why?"
Arlen asked.
"It's the truth.
No messenger keeps working and manages to die of old age."
"But if you know it's going to kill you, then why do it?"
Alyssa demanded. "Because I'd rather live a few years knowing I'm free than spend decades in a prison."
"Milne is hardly a prison, Arlen," Alyssa said.
"It is," he insisted.
"We convince ourselves that it's the whole world, but it isn't. We tell ourselves that there's nothing out there we don't have here, but there is. Why do you think Reagan keeps messaging? He has all the money he could ever spend." "Reagan is in service to the Duke. He has a duty to do the job, because no one else can."
Arlen snorted. "There are other messengers, Alyssa, and Reagan looks at the Duke like he was a bug. He doesn't do it out of loyalty or honor. He does it because he knows the truth."
"What truth?"
"That there's more out there than there is in here," Arlen said.
"I'm pregnant, Arlen," Alyssa said. "Do you think Reagan will find that somewhere else?"
Arlen paused.
"Congratulations," he said at last. "I know how much you wanted it." "That's all you have to say?"
"I suppose you'll expect Reagan to retire then. The father can't risk himself, can he?"
"There are other ways to fight demons, Arlen. Every birth is a victory against them."
"You sound just like my father," Arlen said. Alyssa's eyes widened. As long as she had known Arlen, he'd never spoken of his parents.
"He sounds like a wise man," she said softly.
She'd said the wrong thing. Alyssa knew it immediately. Arlen's face hardened into something she had never seen before, something frightening.
"He wasn't wise," Arlen shouted, throwing a cup of brushes to the floor.
It shattered, sending inky droplets everywhere.
"He was a coward. He let my mother die. He let her die!"
His face screwed up into an anguished grimace, and he stumbled, clenching his fists. Alyssa rushed to him, not knowing what to do or say, only knowing that she wanted to hold him.
"He let her die because he was scared of the night," Arlen whispered.
He tried to resist as her arms encircled him, but she held on tightly as he wept. She held him a long time, stroking his hair. Finally, she whispered,
"Come home, Arlen."
Arlen spent the last year of his apprenticeship living with Reagan and Alyssa, but the nature of their relationship had changed. He was his own man now, and not even Alyssa tried to fight it any longer. To her surprise, her surrender only brought them closer. Arlen doted on her as her belly grew, he and Reagan scheduling their excursion so that she was never alone. Arlen also spent a great deal of time with Alyssa's herb-gatherer midwife. Reagan said a messenger needed to know something of the gatherer's art, so Arlen sought plants and roots that grew beyond the city walls for the woman, and she taught him something of her craft. Reagan stayed close to Milne in those months, and when his daughter Maria was born, he hung up his spear for good. He and Cobb spent that entire night drinking and toasting. Arlen sat with them, but he stared at his glass, lost in thought. "We should make plans," Mary said one evening, as she and Arlen walked to her father's house. "Plans?" Arlen asked. "For the wedding, Goose," Mary laughed. "My father would never let me marry an apprentice, but he'll speak of nothing else once you're a warder." "Messenger," Arlen corrected. Mary looked at him for a long time. "It's time to put your trips aside, Arlen," she said. "You'll be a father soon." "What has that got to do with it?" Arlen asked. "Lots of messengers are fathers." "I won't marry a messenger," Mary said flatly. "You know that. You've always known."
"Just as you've always known, that's what I am," Arlen replied. "Yet here you are."
"I thought you could change," Mary said. "I thought you could escape this delusion that you're somehow trapped, that you need to risk your life to be free. I thought you loved me."
"I do," Arlen said.
"But not enough to give this up," she said. Arlen was quiet. "How can you love me and still do this?" Mary demanded.
"Reagan loves Alyssa," Arlen said. "It's possible to do both."
"Alyssa hates what Reagan does," Mary countered.
"You said so yourself." "And yet they've been married for 15 years, Arlen said.
"Is that what you condemn me to?" Mary asked. "Sleepless nights alone? Not knowing if you'll ever come back? Wondering if you're dead? Or if you've met some minx in another city?"
"That won't happen," Arlen said.
"You're corespond right it won't," Mary said, as tears began to flow down her cheeks. "I won't let it. We're done."
"Mary, please," Arlen said, reaching out to her. But she drew back, evading his grasp.
"We have nothing more to say."
She whirled and ran off toward her father's house. Arlen stood there a long time, staring after her. The shadows grew long, and the sun dipped below the horizon, but still he stood, even at last bell. He shuffled his boots on the cobbled street, wishing the corlings could rise through the worked stone and consume him.
"Arlen! Creator, what are you doing here?" Alyssa cried, rushing to him as he entered the manse. "When the sun went down, we thought you were staying at Cobb's."
"I just needed some time to think," Arlen mumbled.
"Outside, in the dark?"
Arlen shrugged.
"The city is warded. There were no corlings about."
Alyssa opened her mouth to speak, but she caught the look in Arlen's eyes, and the reprimand died on her lips.
"Arlen, what's happened?" she asked softly.
"I told Mary what I told you," Arlen said, laughing numbly.
"She didn't take it as well."
"I don't recall taking it very well myself," Alyssa said. "There you'll find my meaning," Arlen agreed, heading up the stairs. He went to his room and threw open the window, breathing the cold night air and looking out into the darkness. In the morning, he went to see Guildmaster Malcolm. Maria cried before dawn the next morning, but the sound brought relief rather than irritation. Alyssa had heard stories of children dying in the night, and the thought filled her with such terror that the child had to be pried from her arms at bedtime, and her dreams were filled with knotting anxiety. Alyssa swung her feet out of bed and into her slippers as she freed a breast for nursing. Maria pinched the nipple hard, but even the pain was welcome. a sign of strength in her beloved child.
"That's it, Light," she cooed. "Drink and grow strong."
She paced as the child nursed, already dreading being parted from her. Reagan snored contentedly in the bed. After only a few weeks' retirement, he was sleeping better, his nightmares less frequent, and she and Maria kept his days filled that the road might not tempt him. When Maria finally let go, she burped contently and dozed off. Alyssa kissed her and put her back into her nest, going to the door. Margaret was waiting there, as always.
"Good morning, Mother Alyssa," the woman said. The title and the genuine affection with which it was said still filled Alyssa with joy. Even though Margaret had been her servant, they had never before been peers in the way that counted most in Milne.
"Heard the darling's cries," Margaret said. "She's a strong one."
"I need to go out," Alyssa said. "Please prepare a bath and have my blue dress and ermine cloak laid out."
The woman nodded, and Alyssa went back to her child's side. When she was bathed and dressed, Alyssa reluctantly handed the baby to Margaret and went out into the city before her husband awoke. Reagan would reprimand her for meddling, but Alyssa knew that Arlen was teetering on an edge, and she wouldn't let him fall because she failed to act. She glanced about, fearing that Arlen might see her as she entered the library. She didn't find Mary in any of the cells or stacks, but was hardly surprised. Like many of the things personal to him, Arlen didn't speak of Mary often, but Alyssa listened intently when he did. She knew there was a place that was special to them, and she knew the girl would be drawn there. Alyssa found Mary on the library's roof, weeping.
"Mother Alyssa," Mary gasped, hurriedly wiping her tears. "You startled me."
"I'm sorry, dear," Alyssa said, going over to her. "If you want me to go, I will, but I thought you might need someone to talk to."
"Did Arlen send you?" Mary asked.
"No," Alyssa replied. "But I saw how upset he was and knew it must be as hard for you."
"He was upset?" Mary sniffed.
"He wandered the streets in the dark for hours," Alyssa said. "I was worried sick."
Mary shook her head.
"Determined to get himself killed," she murmured.
"I think it's just the opposite," Alyssa said. "I think he's trying desperately to feel alive."
Mary looked at her curiously, and she sat down next to the girl.
"For years," Alyssa said, "I couldn't understand why my husband felt the need to wander far from home, staring down Corlings and risking his life over a few parcels and papers. He'd made money enough to keep us in luxury for 2 lifetimes. Why keep at it?"
"People describe messengers with words like duty, honor, and self-sacrifice. They convince themselves that this is why messengers do what they do."
"It's not?" Mary asked.
"For a time I thought it was," Alyssa said. "But I see things more clearly now. There are times in life when we feel so very alive that when they pass we feel diminished. When that happens, we'll do almost anything to feel so alive again."
"I've never felt diminished," Mary said.
"Neither had I," Alyssa replied. "Not until I became pregnant. Suddenly I was responsible for a life within me. Everything I ate, everything I did, affected it. I'd waited so long that I was terrified of losing the child, as many women my age do."
"You're not so old," Mary protested.
Alyssa only smiled.
"I could feel Maria's life pulsing within me," Alyssa continued, "and mine pulsing in harmony. I'd never felt anything like it. Now, with the baby born, I despair I might never feel it again. I cling to her desperately, but that connection will never be the same."
"What does this have to do with Arlen?" Mary asked.
"I'm telling you how I think messengers feel when they travel," Alyssa said. "For Reagan, I think that the risk of losing his life made him appreciate how precious it is, and sparked an instinct in him that would never allow him to die." For Arlen, it's different. The Corlings have taken a lot from him, Mary, and he blames himself. I think deep down he even hates himself. He blames the Corlings for making him feel that way, and only in defying them can he gain peace. "Oh, Arlen," Mary whispered, tears brimming in her eyes once more. Alyssa reached out and touched her cheek. "But he loves you," she said. "I hear it when he talks about you. I think sometimes when he's busy loving you, he forgets to hate himself." "How have you done it, Mother?" Mary asked. "How have you managed to endure all these years married to a messenger?"
Alyssa sighed.
"Because Reagan is kind-hearted and strong at the same time. And I know how rare that kind of a man is. Because I never doubted that he loved me and would come back. But most of all, because the moments I had with him were worth all the ones apart."
She put her arms around Mary, holding the girl tightly.
"Give him something to come home to, Mary. And I think Arlen will learn that his life is worth something after all." "I don't want him to go at all," Mary said quietly. "I know," Alyssa agreed. "Neither do I. But I don't think I can love him less if he does."
Mary sighed.
"Neither can I," she said.
Arlen was waiting that morning when Jake left for the mill. He had his horse with him, a bay courser with a black mane named Dawn Runner, and his armor on. "What's this?" Jake asked. "Off to Hardin's Grove?"
"And beyond," Arlen said. "I have a commission from the guild to message to Lacton."
"Lacton?" Jake gaped. "It will take you weeks to get there."
"You could come with me," Arlen offered.
"What?"
Jake asked. "As my jongleur," Arlen said.
"Arlen, I'm not ready to..." Jake began.
"Cobb says you learn things best by doing them," Arlen cut him off. "Come with me and we'll learn together.
Do you want to work in the mill forever?"
Jake dropped his eyes to the cobbled street.
"Milling's not so bad," he said, shifting his weight from foot to foot.
Arlen looked at him a moment and nodded. "You take care of yourself, Jake," he said, mounting Dawn Runner.
"When will you be back?" Jake asked.
Arlen shrugged. "I don't know," he said, looking toward the city gates. "Maybe never." Alyssa and Mary returned to the manse later that morning to wait for Arlen's return.
"Don't give in too easily," Alyssa advised as they walked. "You don't want to give all your power away. Make him fight for you, or he'll never understand what you're worth."
"Do you think he will?" Mary asked.
"Oh," Alyssa smiled. "I know he will."
"Have you seen Arlen this morning?" Alyssa asked Margaret when they arrived.
"Yes, Mother," the woman replied.
"A few hours ago. Spent some time with Maria, then left carrying a bag."
"A bag?" Alyssa asked.
Margaret shrugged.
"Probably off to Hardin's Grove or some such."
Alyssa nodded, not surprised that Arlen had chosen to leave town for a day or two.
"He'll be gone through tomorrow at least," she told Mary. "Come and see the baby before you go."
They headed upstairs.
Alyssa cooed as she approached Maria's nest, eager to hold her daughter, but she stopped short when she saw the folded paper tucked partially beneath the baby. Her hand shaking, Alyssa lifted the scrap of parchment and read aloud. "Dear Alyssa and Reagan, I have taken assignment to Lacton from the Messengers Guild. By the time you read this, I will be on the road. I'm sorry I couldn't be what everyone wanted. Thank you for everything. I will never forget you. Arlen."
"No!"
Mary cried. She turned and fled the room, leaving the house at a run.
Reagan! Alyssa cried. Reagan! Her husband came rushing to her side, and he shook his head sadly as he read the note.
Always running from his problems, he muttered.
Well? Alyssa demanded.
Well, what? Reagan asked.
Go and find him, Alyssa cried. Bring him back!
Reagan fixed his wife with a stern look, and without a word spoken, they argued. Alyssa knew it was a losing battle from the start, and soon lowered her eyes.
Too soon, she whispered. Why couldn't he have waited one more day?
Reagan put his arms around her as she started to weep.
Harlan!
Mary cried as she ran. All pretense of calm had flown from her, all interest in seeming strong and making Arlen fight. All she wanted now was to find him before he left and tell him that she loved him and that she would continue loving him no matter what he chose to do. She reached the city gate in record time, panting from exertion, but it was too late. The guards reported that he had left the city hours earlier. Mary knew in her heart he wasn't coming back. If she wanted him, she would have to go after him. She knew how to ride. She could get a horse from Reagan and ride after him. He would surely succor in Hardin's Grove the first night. If she hurried, she could get there in time. She sprinted back to the manse, terror at the thought of losing him giving her fresh strength.
He's gone, she shouted to Alyssa and Reagan. I need to borrow a horse.
Reagan shook his head. It's past midday. You'll never make it in time. You'll get halfway there, and the Corlings will tear you to pieces, he said.
I don't care, Mary cried. I have to try.
She darted for the stables, but Reagan caught her fast. She cried and beat at him, but he was stone, and nothing she did could loosen his grip. Suddenly, Mary understood what Arlen had meant when he said Milne was a prison. And she knew what it was like to feel diminished. It was late before Cobb found the simple letter stuck in the ledger on his countertop. In it, Arlen apologized for leaving early, before his 7 years were up. He hoped Cobb would understand. Cobb read the letter again and again, memorizing every word and the meanings between the lines.
Creator, Arlen, he said. Of course I understand.
Then he wept. Section 3. Crasia. 328 AR. Chapter 17. Ruins. 328 AR.
What are you doing, Arlen? He asked himself as his torchlight flickered invitingly on the stone stairs leading down into the dark.
The sun was dipping low, and it would take several minutes to get back to his camp. But the stairs called to him in a way he couldn't explain. Cobb and Reagan had warned him about this. The thought of treasures that might be found in ruins was too much for some messengers, and they took risks, stupid risks. Arlen knew he was one of these, but he could never resist exploring the lost dots on the map, as Tender Ronald had put it. The money he made messaging paid for these excursions, sometimes taking him days from the nearest road. But for all his effort, he had found only dregs. His thoughts flashed back to the pile of books from the old world that crumbled to dust when he tried to pick them up. The rusted blade that gashed his hand and infected it so badly he felt his arm was on fire. The wine cellar that caved in and trapped him for 3 days until he dug himself out without a bottle to show for it. Ruin hunting never paid off, and one day, he knew, it would be the death of him. Go back, he urged himself. Have a bite, check your wards, get some rest. The night take you, Arlen cursed himself, and headed down the stairs. But for all his self-loathing, Arlen's heart pounded with excitement.
He felt free and alive beyond anything the free cities could offer. This was why he became a messenger. He reached the bottom of the stairs and dragged a sleeve across his sweating brow, taking a brief pull from his water skin. Hot as it was hard to imagine that after sunset, the desert above would drop to near freezing temperatures. He moved along a gritty corridor of fitted stones, his torchlight dancing along the walls like shadow demons. Are there shadow demons? He wondered. That would be just my luck. He sighed. There was so much he still didn't know. He'd learned much in the last 3 years, soaking up knowledge of other cultures and their struggles with the Corlings like a sponge. In the Angerian forest, he had spent weeks studying wood demons. In Lacton, he learned of boats beyond the small two-man canoes used in Tibbetts Brook, and paid for his curiosity about water demons with a puckered scar on his arm. He'd been lucky, able to plant his feet and haul on the tentacle, dragging the Corling from the water. Unable to abide the air, the nightmarish creature had let go and slipped beneath the surface once more. He spent months there, learning water wards. Fort Risen was much like home, less a city than a cluster of farming communities, each helping one another to ease the inevitable losses to Corlings who bypass the ward posts. But Fort Crasia, the desert spear, was Arlen's favorite. Crasia of the stinging wind, where the days burned and the cold nights brought forth sand demons from the dunes. Crasia, where they still fought. The men of Fort Crasia hadn't allowed themselves to succumb to despair. They waged a nightly battle against the Corlings, locking away their wives and children and taking up spear and net. Their weapons, like those Arlen carried, could do little to pierce the tough skin of a Corling, but they stung the demons, and were enough to harass them into warded traps until the desert sun rose to reduce them to ashes. Their determination was an inspiration. But for all he had learned, Arlen only hungered for more. Every city had taught him something unknown in the others. Somewhere out there had to be the answers he sought. Thus, this latest ruin. Half buried in sand, almost forgotten, save for a crumbling Crasian map Arlen had discovered, the city of Anaxun had stood untouched for hundreds of years. Much of the surface was collapsed or worn down by wind and sand. But the lower levels, cut deep into the ground, were intact. Arlen turned a corner, and his breath caught. Up ahead, in the dim, flickering light, he saw pitted symbols cut into the stone pillars to either side of the corridor. Wards. Holding the torch close, Arlen inspected them. They were old, ancient. The very air about them was stale with the weight of centuries. He took paper and charcoal from his satchel to make rubbings. Then, swallowing hard, continued on, lightly stirring the dust of ages. He came to a stone door at the end of the hall. It was painted with faded and chipped wards, few of which Arlen recognized. He pulled out his notebook and copied those intact enough to be made out, then moved to inspect the door. It was more a slab than a door, and Arlen soon realized that nothing held it in place save its own weight. Taking up his spear to use as a lever, he wedged the metal tip into the seam between the slab and the wall, and heaved. The point of the spear snapped off. Night, Arlen cursed. As far from Milne, metal was rare and expensive. Refusing to be balked, he took a hammer and chisel from his back and hacked at the wall itself. The sandstone cut easily, and soon he had carved a nook wide enough to work the shaft of his spear into the room beyond. The spear was thick and sturdy, and this time when Arlen threw his weight against the lever, he felt the great slab shift slightly. Still, the wood would break before it moved. Using the chisel, Arlen pried up the floor stones at the door's base, digging a deep groove for it to tip into. If he could shift the stone that far, its own inertia would keep it in motion. Moving back to the spear, he heaved once more. The stone resisted, but Arlen persevered, grinding his teeth with the effort. Finally, with a thunderous impact, the slab toppled to the ground, leaving a narrow gap in the wall choked with dust. Arlen moved into what appeared to be a burial chamber. The air reeked of age, but already fresher air was flooding the chamber from the corridor. Holding up his torch, he saw that the walls were brightly painted with tiny stylized figures, depicting countless battles of humans against demons. Battles that the humans seemed to be winning. In the center of the room stood an obsidian coffin, cut roughly in the shape of a man holding a spear. Arlen approached the coffin, noting the wards along its length. He reached out to touch them, and realized his hands were shaking. He knew there was little time remaining before sunset, but Arlen couldn't have turned away now if all the demons in the core rose up against him. Breathing deeply, he moved to the head of the sarcophagus and pushed hard, forcing the lid down so that it would tilt to the floor without breaking. Arlen knew he should have copied the wards before trying this, but taking the time to copy them would have meant coming back in the morning, and he simply couldn't wait. The heavy stone moved slowly, and Arlen's face reddened with the strain as he pushed, his muscles knotted and bunched. The wall was close behind him, and he braced a foot against it for leverage. With a scream that echoed down the corridor, he shoved with all his might, and the cover slid off, crashing to the ground. Arlen paid the lid no mind, staring at the contents of the great coffin. The body wrapped inside was remarkably intact, but it couldn't hold his attention. All Arlen could see was the object clutched in its bandaged hands, a metal spear. Sliding the weapon reverently from the corpse's stubborn grasp, Arlen marveled at its lightness. It was 7 foot long from tip to tip, and the shaft was more than an inch in diameter. The point was still sharp enough to draw blood after so many years. The metal was unknown to Arlen, but that fact flew from his thoughts as he noted something else. The spear was warded. All along its silvery surface the etchings ran, a level of craftsmanship unknown in modern times. The wards were unlike anything he had ever seen. As Arlen became aware of the enormity of his find, he realized, too, the danger he was in. The sun was setting above. Nothing he had found here would matter if he died before bringing it back to civilization. Snatching up his torch, Arlen bolted out of the burial chamber and sprinted down the hall, taking the steps 3 at a time. He darted through the maze of passages on instinct, praying that his twists and turns were true. Finally, he saw the exit to the dusty, half-buried streets, but not a sliver of light could be seen through the doorway. As he reached the exit, he saw that the sky was still tinged with color. The sun had only just set. His camp was in sight, and the corlings were just beginning to rise. Without pausing to consider his actions, Arlen dropped his torch and charged out of the building, scattering the sand as he zigzagged around the rising sand demons. Cousins to rock demons, sand demons were smaller and more nimble, but still among the strongest and most armored of the corling breeds. They had small, sharp scales, a dirty yellow, almost indistinguishable from the grit, instead of the large charcoal gray plates of their rock demon cousins, and they ran on all fours, where rock demons stood hunched on 2 legs. But their faces were the same. Rows of segmented teeth jutted out on their jaws like a snout, while their nostril slits rested far back, just below their large lidless eyes. Thick bones from their brows curved upward and back, cutting through the scales as sharp horns. Their brows twitched continually as they squeezed down, displacing the ever-blowing sand. And even more frightening than their larger cousins, sand demons hunted in packs. They would work together to see him cored. His heart pounding and his discovery forgotten, Arlen moved through the ruins with incredible speed and alacrity, vaulting fallen pillars and crumbled rock while dodging right and left around the solidifying corlings. Demons needed a moment to get their bearings on the surface, and Arlen took full advantage of that.